On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. After promising an America First foreign policy, last night President Trump ordered the bombing of a Syrian airbase in response to Bashar al-Assad's latest use of chemical weapons. Steve Bannon is out as a member of the NSC. David Nunes is out, at least temporarily, as the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and also out a 60-vote requirement for Supreme Court nominees. The job numbers are in. They're not nearly as good as economists had predicted they'd be, and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is in, it seems, on just about everything. We begin today with Senator Chris Van Hollen, who won the seat vacated by Barbara Mikulski last year. Then I'm joined by Domenico Montanaro from NPR and Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. We're going to start with Senator Chris Van Hollen. He was elected to the Senate last November. After serving seven terms in Congress, he holds the seat held for many years by Barbara Mikulski. Like Senator Mikulski, Senator Van Hollen has landed a spot on the Appropriations Committee. He's also serving on the Budget, Banking, and Agriculture Committees, and as the chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, he's deeply involved in Democratic strategy for the 2018 election cycle, among many other duties. Senator, it's good to talk to you. How are you doing?
Tom, great to be with you.
And I haven't talked to you since the election, so congratulations. There's certainly been a lot on your plate and those of fellow senators. Let's talk first about Syria. It appears that the president had a change of heart about Bashar al-Assad after he got news of the chemical attack that took place earlier this week. What's your response to the president's decision to bomb the airfield from whence the chemical weapons are putatively, you know, originated? And more broadly, what do you think our posture with Syria should be?
Well, first, thank you again for the chance to be with you, and I want to thank all the voters of Maryland for participating in the last election, and look forward to representing everybody, whether they voted for me or not, to try to advance Maryland's interest as well as the values and priorities of the country. Look, I believe that taking proportionate action to punish Assad for his use of chemical weapons, which is a gross violation of both international law as well as the agreement the Syrian government entered into, was an appropriate action. I thought it was appropriate to take action against the airfield that was the launching point for the chemical weapon attacks, both as a punitive response and also a signal that if we see repeated use of chemical weapons in Syria, they'll be met by similar proportionate responses. However, I am deeply worried about the United States getting dragged deeper into military action in Syria, and have called upon the Trump administration and Donald Trump to make sure that they engage Congress and we have a full debate and any and congressional action before you have much broader military action in Syria, because I think it would be a big mistake to get sucked into a big military confrontation in Syria in the way we did in Iraq.
President Obama went to Congress back in 2013 looking for an authorization, the kind of thing that you're talking about here, and he never got it, never made it to a vote on the floor. I mean, if President Trump asked for an authorization for further military intervention in Syria, would you support that? And do you have a sense that the Senate as a whole would support it?
Well, as I indicated, I would not support any broad grant of authority to President Trump to take deep military action in Syria. I think that would be a mistake. I was one of the people who looked to fashion a very narrow authorization for President Obama that would allow this kind of punitive and appropriate and proportionate retaliatory action for use of chemical weapons. And I can support that kind of response because I do think it's in our national interests and in the and frankly the interests of humanity to make sure that we keep that line that prohibits the use of chemical weapons. It's a gross violation of international law, and as we know, it's also a violation of the agreement. So I support that, but what happens is when Congress considers some of these authorizations to use military force, very quickly the executive wants more expanded authority. And as I say, I think it would be a very big mistake for the United States to be putting troops on the ground in harm's way in Syria. And I also want to hear the larger strategy that this administration is proposing with respect to Syria.
Does it concern you at all that this was done unilaterally, that there was no participation or apparent consultation with any other governments in opposition to Assad?
Well, I think there was limited, at least providing notice to for example, Russians, to make sure that we didn't, in the process of taking action in Syria, hit Russians that may be on the ground. And while we have obviously really big disputes with the Russians, both in Syria and elsewhere, it would be important to avoid direct conflict with them in Syria. But no, look, I think this was a timely action, and I do think it was a proportionate action. And I, said that at the time that Syria first used chemical weapons during the Obama administration. In that case, of course, President Obama threatened the use of force and then actually was able to get an agreement. And the agreement was that Assad would get rid of all his chemical weapons and not use them again. Well, now it turns out that they've violated that agreement. And so I think this response, again, hitting the airfield that was used to launch those chemical weapons attacks against civilians, is appropriate. What would be inappropriate would be for this to somehow open the door to much broader U.S. military involvement without any kind of congressional action. As I indicated, Tom, I would be very resistant to opening that door wide.
Within the last hour, the Senate has confirmed Judge Neil Gorsuch to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Lots of concern about the Republicans invoking the so-called nuclear option, which made it possible to override a filibuster without the 60 votes that it used to take to do that. Your concerns about that action on behalf of on that action by the Senate, and do you see this as a slippery slope for example, legislative matters being able to be handled in this way without a 60-vote majority?
Well, this is certainly a sad day for the Senate, and I think it's a bad day for the country, because the 60-vote standard for a Supreme Court justice is designed to encourage consensus within the Senate, right? We have 100 members, and a strict majority vote, of course, would allow someone to pass with 51 votes. And the idea of the 60 votes was to make sure you can build some consensus around a nominee. And previous presidents have consulted members of the Senate from both parties, Republicans or Democrats, before sending down a nominee. In this case, Donald Trump did not do that. He did contract out the process of selecting a justice to some very right-wing groups, the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society. He said, put together a list of names of people that you like, and they came up with Gorsuch as one of the 20, and the president dutifully picked one off that list. And so it should be no surprise that Judge Gorsuch, when you dig deep into his record, you discover that he consistently sides with powerful corporate special interests against the interests of working people and individual rights, which is why the analysis that appeared in the New York Times showed that he would be the second most conservative of the current justices on the Supreme Court. And the Washington Post did an analysis indicating that he would be the most conservative to the right of Clarence Thomas. So It is really a sad day that they changed this 60-vote rule, which was designed to encourage consensus and designed to encourage mainstream nominees. I should point out that Neil Gorsuch is a very good lawyer. He's very skilled. He answered questions in a way that provided primarily platitudes and little substance. But, you know, he has a moderate temperament, but that does not mean he has a moderate record.
What do you make of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's assessment that Judge Gorsuch, while on the appeals court in Colorado, voted with the majority, you know, 90-plus percent of the time?
Well, you can look at his, you know, votes in the majority, but it's also really important to look at when and why he was in the minority. So one of his decisions that was very much highlighted recently was with respect to the rights of individuals with disabilities and their ability to get a full education. In a case involving a request for more inclusive education, Neil Gorsuch was the one judge against the rights of that individual. And in the middle of his testimony, while he was testifying for his current nomination to the Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, by an 8-0 decision, found the opposite way that Judge Gorsuch had ruled in that case. The full Supreme Court decided that this child with disabilities should be given a full opportunity for a good and quality education. That's one example. There have been many others, and I think that is why you had these independent analyses that appeared showing that he would be, you know, far out on the right, even in with the current conservative court.
Many people in the Senate, both on both sides of the aisle, worry that this is, as we say, the slippery slope, which could lead to the 60-vote requirement being taken away for legislative matters. Do you have a sense that that might happen? There's a lot of people pretty afraid of that.
Well, as they should be. I mean, I worry about that a lot, because what makes the Senate different from the House is the House is a strictly majoritarian run institution, right? If you're the majority party and you can enforce party discipline, you can jam anything you want through the House of Representatives. What makes the Senate different is really less the fact that it has 100 instead of 435, but the rules and the current rules for legislation, as they had been for Supreme Court, are designed to encourage that kind of consensus building. So, for example, a few years ago, that encouragement is what resulted in the Senate passing bipartisan legislation for comprehensive immigration reform. The Democrats were in the majority, but they were joined by people like, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and many other Republicans to pass that. And that's an example of how the Senate can build consensus. When that bill went to the House, the previous Speaker, John Boehner, refused to even hold a vote on it. So that's where the majority just says, you know what, you know, we don't care. We're not even going to allow democracy to work. We're not even going to allow a vote on that. So maintaining the current 60-vote requirement for controversial legislation is really important, and you would totally destroy the character of the Senate if you got rid of that. And more importantly for the country, you would destroy the rules that encourage that kind of consensus building. And we are in a deeply polarized environment, and it seems to me the last thing we want to do is to take away rules that are designed to build more consensus and create more cooperation.
And Senator, I know you're busy and you got to run, but let me ask you one political question. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the Republican National Committee has raised $53 million in the first quarter of this year. You're heading the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. You've got some tough races coming up in the 2018 election. The filibuster against Judge Gorsuch was fueled in in some measure at least, by, you know, activists and grassroots folks in the Democratic Party insisting on a you know, strident opposition to President Trump's nominee. I mean, what do you sense the mood of the party is, and as you look forward to the next cycle?
Well, I am encouraged by the incredible outpouring of grassroots support, saying loudly and clearly that we're not going to turn back the clock in the United States of America. We saw the huge outpouring of support the day after President Trump's inauguration, with the women's marches in Washington and really across the country. And so there's a whole lot of energy, and people are mobilizing. And I also think, Tom, that the more time that goes on and we see the Trump administration laying out its agenda, whether it's the budget or, you know, their effort to blow up the Affordable Care Act while providing these huge tax breaks to very wealthy people, the more they lay out their agenda, the more a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump, candidate Trump, will see that the way they're governing is really a betrayal of what was said on the campaign trail. And so I think you're going to see a lot of momentum in support, not just of the Democratic Party, but of sort of common sense approach to policy and politics. And speaking of common sense, Tom, I do want to commend the judge in Baltimore for upholding the consent decree between the Justice Department and Baltimore City and the Baltimore City Police Department. As we know, Attorney General Jeff Sessions had tried to reverse that or put a pause on it. So I'm very pleased to see the action by the court, and it underscores the importance of an independent judiciary, something that, you know, Donald Trump doesn't seem to like, but is essential for the rule of law and the protection of our rights.
Senator Chris Van Hollen has joined us on the phone from Capitol Hill. Senator, I know you're busy today. I appreciate the time, and I look forward to chatting again soon. Thanks.
Likewise. Thanks for checking in.
Coming up after a break, the Midday News Wrap, I'll be joined by Domenico Montanaro of NPR and Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. We'll take your calls and comments on the news of the day in this very busy week. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. More on the News Wrap when we come back from a break. Stick around.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Domenico Montanaro joins us now on the line from NPR in Washington. He's NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. Domenico, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with me here in Studio A, Luke Broadwater. He's an award-winning reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Luke, good to see you.
Good afternoon.
You are welcome to join our conversation about the news of the day, the news of the week. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. So, Domenico, with this strike in Syria that the president ordered last night, with his summit meeting with President Xi Jinping of China at Mar-a-Lago over the weekend, with his appearance with Jordan King Abdullah, Egypt's President El-Sisi, is there anything detectable about a coherent foreign policy in the Trump administration that's beginning to take shape?
Well, you know, what's funny is I think Hillary Clinton probably would have done exactly the same action. But the difference in reaction from liberals and conservatives across the board would have been far less confused because she had laid out that kind of policy during the campaign. Trump had taken the completely different tack, not only during the campaign, but as recently as 2 days ago, his administration was saying that Assad was not the point, that they were there in Syria to try to fight ISIS. But Trump sitting in the White House, seeing the images of children having been gassed or dealt with nerve agents, apparently moved him enough to feel like this was something that needed to be responded to. And now it's changed the entire complexion of how the U.S. deals with Syria and with Russia. And there are lots of questions here on what is the coherence? Is there a coherent strategy going forward?
And Luke Broadwater, what's surprising to a lot of folks is that the use of chemical weapons by Assad is not new. This happened years ago. I mean, so one wonders why the president wasn't moved when it happened years ago and got moved because it happened this week.
That's right. And if you remember, Tom, back in 2013, then citizen Donald Trump was extremely critical of President Obama for even considering using military action in Syria after the last chemical attack done by Assad. And I think that people are right to say, what is the policy here? Because on the one hand, we are banning Syrian refugees from the country. On the other hand, we care so much about these same people that we're willing to use bombs and military strikes. So do we care about the Syrian children or not?
And Domenico, the political fallout of this has been interesting to watch. There are a lot of folks on the extreme right who are very much opposed to Mr. Trump's decision because they were counting on his, you know, sort of America first perspective on this and staying out of more difficulties
in
conflicts in the Middle East.
Sure. Well, I don't think that this kind of crosses any kind of threshold for those folks to suddenly turn around and say, boy, I didn't want to bomb a country because they were gassing people. You know, I think that fundamentally his people believe in toughness, and Donald Trump was able to sort of promote this machismo during the campaign to say, mess with me and I'm going to hit you back even harder. You know, he would do that with insults on the campaign trail. Someone go after him, he's going to go even lower and take them down. So this kind of makes perfect sense within that realm. However, if he were, and I think he's very cautious about this or understands this, if he were to go a step further, as you heard from Senator Van Hollen, you know, while he's getting support right now from both sides, if not reluctantly from Democrats for what he'd done, if he goes any further than this, if this indicates any kind of a wider strategy, if it indicates going in unilaterally to rebuild the country and nation build, then that's absolutely someplace where not only would his supporters probably have some pause, but most Americans would have pause given what happened with Iraq.
And Luke Broadwater, folks are already concerned. Russia and Iran, of course, condemned the attack on the air base in Syria, and Russia has vowed to boost Syrian air defense capability. This could easily escalate into, you know, Syria has long been thought of as a sort of proxy situation between the U.S. and Russia. This could get out of hand quick and badly, couldn't it?
Yeah, you have, you know, the Russians there. You have all different competing factions in Syria. One could easily see, I mean, we already saw a conflict almost break out between Turkey and Russia. So you could, if a missile hits the wrong target, if a plane is shot down accidentally, we have all these world powers now in this same place. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned about what would happen if there's a mistake.
And Domenico, what's your take on the president's sort of countenance this week? I mean, a lot of folks, when they saw him in his, you know, press conference with Jordan King Abdullah or even with El-Sisi, he looked like a fish out of water to an awful lot of folks, a bumbler. I mean, this business of when a reporter asked him, had the chemical attacks crossed a line, he said it crossed many lines. I mean, it really just didn't seem like he had a firm grasp of what was going on. This is, of course, a suspicion that a lot of people have had, you know, ever since he announced his candidacy a year and a half ago. But how do you think he did this week in terms of shoring up confidence in the electorate?
Well, he also has this big meeting with President Xi of China, which is ongoing, and notably launched this attack while Xi was at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, the southern White House. And I do think that it's been a key week on foreign policy, especially as his White House has been somewhat marred by all this chaos that's been going on with all the palace intrigue that's been something of a cross between House of Cards and Veep, you know, really. So, you know, and I think there's been a lot of questions on Donald Trump's support for autocracies around the world. You know, El-Sisi is somebody who President Obama wouldn't meet with whatsoever because of these accusations of human rights atrocities, murder, kidnapping, jailing of dissidents. And Trump embraced him, said the United States is a strong backer of Egypt. And that is fundamentally something that is aligned in very much the same way of the way Vladimir Putin has tried to urge the United States to shift, to say the Arab Spring was a problem throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa because it destabilized a lot of these countries. Yeah, democracy is great as a goal, but wouldn't you rather have stability if you're Russia or the United States? That's been the argument. And Assad, leaving him in power, seemed to be the new way that the United States was moving. You heard Nikki Haley, Rex Tillerson, the UN ambassador and the Secretary of State, talk about how Assad was not the goal. So whether or not that even the question of whether or not that enabled somewhat Assad to test the boundaries of what could be done or should be done in that region is a question a lot of people are raising in the diplomatic community as well.
It's the Midday News Wrap. That's Domenico Montanaro. He's the lead political editor at NPR. He joins us on the line from Washington. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun is with me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Luke, let's talk a little bit about the palace intrigue that Domenico brought up. We have Steve Bannon out as part of the Principals Committee on the National Security Council. A lot of folks interpreting that as an ascendance or an elevation of Lieutenant General McMaster, who's the NSC advisor, you know, being able to put his folks in place and do things on the NSC his way. How do you take that?
I think a lot of people view Bannon as kind of the boogeyman inside the Trump administration. I mean, Saturday Night Live depicts him as literally the angel of death. So they
the Grim Reaper,
right?
The
Grim Reaper. So, yeah,
and
right.
He's happy to call himself Darth Vader. I mean, it's enough.
Yeah. So you know, I think that almost any time Bannon is pulled back from things, that is seen by many, especially Democrats and moderate Republicans, as a good thing. On the other hand, when you know that people like General Mattis and McMaster are behind the scenes on some of these military actions, I think that gives certainly Democrats and moderate Republicans a sense of confidence that there is a steady hand, an experienced hand at the wheel. And that's why I think there was so much concern about Bannon being on that panel, is he's a political actor. You know, he's somebody who's from Breitbart News, so he comes from a certain segment of the population. He doesn't have the same experience that these generals do.
And Domenico, a couple of weeks ago, we heard lots of stories about the tension and the war going on between Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, and Steve Bannon. Now right. Those stories have changed to say that Bannon and Priebus are in cahoots against Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who has right. An awfully large portfolio. What do you make of that? I mean, is any of this stuff is any of this stuff credible? I mean, do we really know what's going on inside this White House?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are all these kinds of different alliances, but, you know, it's one of my pet peeves that there's this philosophy within certain reporting, political reporting structures, that they believe that if you understand these strategists, that they're sort of these puppet masters who can play a president or a politician one way or the other. And so understand them and you understand power, you understand the politician. I'm sort of the opposite. I subscribe more to the notion, and especially with Donald Trump, that most of the people I've ever encountered in politics, those staffers more often than not reflect their boss rather than the boss reflecting their staffers. You know, you hear people yelling down the hallway on the phone so that you know, people who were relatively nice to you a cycle ago now suddenly are yelling so that their boss can hear them because their boss is now doesn't like the press. You know, that's more often what happens. But there's no doubt that there's this drama going on. There's no doubt that there are people who are angling to get in Trump's ear. And there's no question that Steve Bannon was demoted. That is H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. trying to normalize the National Security Council. This is somebody who has been in the military his entire life. He's 54 years old. He doesn't like to look around and see a non-normal looking structure for the National Security Council. So he no doubt tried to normalize it, but his influence is limited as well. There's a 30-year-old senior director for intelligence on that committee, on the National Security Council, who he wanted out, the New York Times reported, but then he couldn't get him out because the guy complained to Jared Kushner. So no question about it, the blood is thicker than staffers. Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, they are always going to have Trump's ear more so than anybody else in the White House.
And Luke Broadwater, here's Mr. Kushner. He's in his mid-30s, and he seems to have a portfolio that includes everything. I mean, he's doing foreign policy. He took a surprise trip to Iraq. He was evidently instrumental in arranging the summit with President Xi of China. He's taking on police reform. He's taking on – you name it, he's taking it on. What does that say about the organizational structure of this White House?
I think it is kind of amazing when you look at the Trump cabinet that you have people who are amazingly qualified in some jobs. You look at a General Mattis, for instance. Then on the other hand, you have people with literally no qualifications for the jobs they've been put in. And it's not just Jared Kushner. You look at a Ben Carson, who is a wonderful, wonderful doctor, but not, one would not think of as a housing policy expert. So again, Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner, should they have as much responsibility as they do? Should they have these high ranking positions?
And Domenico Montanaro, do you buy, for example, the analogy between Jared Kushner and Valerie Jarrett? A lot of people pointed to Valerie Jarrett as a person that was the go-to person for just any number of things by President Obama. And here's another person who did not come into the White House with any particular portfolio, great political experience. And they just say that, you know, when you get to that position, when you've been through a campaign, when you've got all these hangers on, you really need one or two people you can really just intrinsically trust. And maybe Trump, the way he's run his businesses so far, he just simply trusts his daughter and the guy she married.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, there's no question there's a parallel because he relied on President Obama relied on Valerie Jarrett for advice. She was somebody who had a seat at his table, not at the National Security Council's Principals Committee, but was somebody that he did rely on for advice, who didn't necessarily have the background or policy experience or diplomatic chops that you would want for somebody who's going to be a major envoy. Now, at the same time, where the analogy sort of falls short is that Valerie Jarrett was one person out of a whole slew of people that President Obama relied on. There were unquestionably qualified professionals within the Obama White House and administration who the president also relied on to help him make important decisions. He wasn't sending Valerie Jarrett to Iraq and putting her in charge of Mideast peace in some ambiguous way, and also being some envoy to business leaders to come up with an American innovation task force. That's more something you would see Joe Biden do, for example. President Trump is relying much more heavily on Jared Kushner than President Obama relied on Valerie Jarrett.
Before we take a little break, I want to bring to your attention this item in the news this hour. The Enoch Pratt Library here in Baltimore has announced the appointment of Heidi Daniel as the new president of the Pratt. She comes to Baltimore from Ohio, where she's been leading the Youngstown and Mahoning County library systems for the past 5 years. She will begin her tenure as the head of the Pratt Library on August 1st. She succeeds Dr. Carla Hayden, who is now the Librarian of Congress in Washington. The announcement of Heidi Daniel as the new head of the Pratt was scheduled to be made at the Pennsylvania Avenue branch of the library about an hour ago, and we assume that that happened. We will be back with more of the Midday News Wrap with Luke Broadwater, who covers City Hall and local politics for the Baltimore Sun, and Domenico Montanaro. He's the lead political editor at NPR. You are welcome to join our conversation on the News Wrap, 410-662-8780. That's our number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. We will be right back.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. Domenico Montanaro joins us on the line from Washington. He oversees NPR's political coverage on the radio and online. Luke Broadwater is an award-winning journalist who's a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. You are welcome to join us if you'd like. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Domenico, let me have us listen to a little clip of Senator John McCain talking about the decision by Majority Leader McConnell to invoke the nuclear option regarding Judge Gorsuch's nomination.
I think it was a dark day in the history of the United States Senate. It's interesting that Republicans were dead set against it when my former colleague Harry Reid invoked it with the judges, but now it seems to be okay. What we should have done is what we did in 2005, and that was a group of us got together, 14 of us, and said, look, we won't filibuster except under extraordinary conditions. And now we're so polarized now, including between the two leaders, Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, that there's no communications anymore. But look, if you can do this with 51 votes, what do you think the next nominee is going to be like? And then what do you think is going to happen when eventually the Democrats are in the majority in the Senate? And that's going to happen sooner or later. I hope later.
So Domenico Montanaro, he hopes later. A lot of people do. I mean, it was Republicans and Democrats calling it a dark day when the nuclear option was invoked. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, how does this play out? And do you think that there's any chance of a slippery slope of the filibuster rule being applied to legislative matters, not just judicial matters?
Well, I laugh because John McCain voted for this thing.
I mean, as did all of the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, he decries the the change. He and Susan Collins from Maine have been people who've talked out against this over the years, and I think most people expected both of them to vote the other direction. Possibly because you could hear how passionate McCain is about this, but he went over the cliff anyway with it. As far as whether or not it goes to the point of legislation, there's a whole lot more. There are a whole lot more Republicans who are against that. We had Roy Blunt from Missouri on our air here on All Things Considered, and he said that he thinks that that would be too far. 10 years ago, people were saying the Supreme Court would be too far. And I think undoubtedly McCain makes a good point in the sense that this is reflective of the polarization going on writ large throughout the country. You know, people can curate their Facebook feeds to get only the kind of information that they want. There's tremendous confirmation bias that's been happening since the early aughts and the year 2000, when you could watch cable news and it's strategist A versus strategist B who are yelling at each other and you never learn the truth. So people went to Fox News and MSNBC later to find out what their truth was, or even further to the left or right in Reddit chains or whatever you want to look at online. And that has become the norm, unfortunately, in this country. You've seen, people have done studies on this. The Brookings Institution has this great chart of dots that you can see over the years how much more partisan the country has become. Some people blame that, of course, on people in Congress not sticking around as long, the smell of jet fuel being in the air and wanting to get home to their districts. But they reflect the country at large. And until there's a penalty for partisanship in congressional races, then you're going to just see this continue to get worse and worse.
And Luke Broadwater, it's true, as Domenico says, the bifurcation politically in this country has never been, it seems never to have been as terrible. I mean, maybe sometime in the 19th century. I'm not sure. I wasn't around then. But the Wall Street Journal.
I think the Civil War probably.
Yeah, the Civil War was pretty bifurcated, as I recall. The Wall Street Journal, again, reporting today that the RNC has raised $53 million in just this first quarter. That was sort of exceeded a lot of people's expectations. A lot of small donors, in other words, people who supported President Trump. Chris Van Hollen, who we talked to earlier today, heads up the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and he's got a tough row to hoe coming up in 2018 because there are a bunch of states, Indiana, Missouri, Montana, North Dakota, West Virginia, where Trump won, and he's got Democrats Democrats running in exposed seats. Given the bifurcation and given that it seems to get worse, now we have this, you know, the filibuster rule being overturned for Supreme Court judges. What does this bode? How does this bode for the Democrats coming up in the midterms?
Well, I know that Chris Van Hollen is a reputable fundraiser, that he is someone who's has people really believe does a good job in that role. That said, I think if you look at the playing field here, it's there are many more Democratic seats in play than Republican seats, and if you just look at it on paper, it looks like it's going to be another good year for the Republicans. That said, midterm elections, everyone says always there's usually some backlash against the dominant party. So obviously we'll have to wait and see. And I think everyone's right that we are seeing certainly much more partisanship than we saw only 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, when Justice Scalia was appointed, who's most people see as a very strident conservative, it was unanimous. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed, it was like 96 or 97 votes of the Senate for her. And I think most people think she's solidly on the left. So they were judged based on their qualifications. And these last two nominees, it's been about who the president was that appointed them, not whether or not they're qualified for the job.
And Domenico, when we talk about the vitriol and the vulgarity of the public discourse that was certainly in evidence in the campaign, and many people place that squarely on the shoulders of candidate Donald Trump, it's interesting that this week Bill O'Reilly at Fox News has been much in the news himself. He began 10 days ago or so insulting Congresswoman Maxine Waters' hairstyle and finished the week with advertisers fleeing like crazy from his program because of an article in the New York Times in which a number of women have alleged just horrible, horrible behavior on his part, behavior that evidently was also evidenced by Roger Ailes, who has since left the network. As of Wednesday night, 52 advertisers have decided they no longer want to be part of the Bill O'Reilly show, which is the highest rated show in Fox News. I guess it's a kind of a chicken and egg thing. Is the vulgarity of people like Trump cause O'Reilly to become more vulgar, or does O'Reilly's vulgarity make it possible for Trump to even come on the scene?
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of empathy, right? I mean, there's not a lot of taking the high road on either side, because liberals aren't blameless in this. Everybody lives in their own bubble. Talk radio has been around forever, and it's been something that Republicans have been able to use over the last 20, 30 years to, you know, instill that confirmation bias. Like, here is the truth that people are going to tell you. You know, Rush Limbaugh, tons of people listen, millions of people listen to Rush Limbaugh. And, you know, there is the same kind of attitude that then emerged, I think, in the about 10, 15 years ago on the left, where you started to see the rise of folks on the left being able to say, this is what you need to know, and arming themselves. And I think because neighborhoods even are so fractured, you don't have a lot of people even working together or living close to each other who know people who think differently politically and open enough to hear out their points. Instead, it's black and white. You know, everybody is good or bad, good and evil. If you voted for Trump, you're an evil person. If you voted for Hillary Clinton, how could you? Because she belonged in jail. You know, these are the kinds of vitriolic discussions that people were having. And the embers were there for this for quite some time. And undoubtedly, Trump used it to fuel his campaign.
When it comes to truth, we had a change of command in the House Intelligence Committee. Here's Speaker Paul Ryan discussing Devin Nunes and his decision to recuse himself from that investigation of Russian meddling into elections.
Devin Nunes has earned my trust over many years for his integrity and his dedication to the critical work that the intelligence community does to keep Americans safe. He continues to have that trust, and I know he is eager to demonstrate to the Ethics Committee that he has followed all proper guidelines and laws. In the meantime, it is clear that this process would be a distraction to the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in our election. So Chairman Nunes has offered to step aside as the lead Republican on this particular probe, and I fully support his decision. Representative Mike Conaway, a senior member of the committee, will now lead this investigation with respect to House Republicans on the Intelligence Committee. I'm confident that he will oversee a professional investigation into Russia's actions and follow the facts wherever they may lead.
And Luke Broadwater, the whole affair surrounding Devin Nunes gets curiouser and curiouser. We've got midnight meetings at the White House, and now he's sneaking out the Capitol having, recused himself. What do you think this means for public trust in the integrity of the process of the House Intelligence Committee?
You know, I'm not sure how I would love to see a poll of that, because I can't believe that too many people are trustworthy of someone leading an investigation into the Trump administration who was part of Trump's team, you know. So in general, I think that there would be a lot of skepticism about that.
And Domenico Montanaro, what can you tell us about Texas Republican Mike Conaway, who's going to take Nunes's place as the head of the committee?
Well, I don't know a ton about Conaway, but I know he's not Devin Nunes.
He's got that going for him. Yeah.
In the sense that, I mean, Nunes took way too many steps that just called into question his ability to be to conduct an impartial investigation. You know, this became a major problem for him. You can't go to the White House grounds and get information from National Security Council officials that you then use at a press conference the day after the FBI director says that there was no wiretapping, to say that there was incidental surveillance. You know, it just there were too many steps that he took. Look at the difference with how Richard Burr, the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman from North Carolina, how he handled it. He was able to say, look, I voted for Donald Trump, but because of that, I know I need to draw even brighter boundaries around myself, and you're not going to be able to say I can't conduct an impartial investigation. And then he got a hand on the shoulder from Virginia Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat, who said, I have full confidence in Richard Burr that he can do this job. So they are going to know that if they want to appear impartial and be able to do the job, you can't go doing things like getting information from the White House grounds and then briefing the president on what you just saw.
So before, we just got a couple minutes left here. Luke Broadwater, I want to talk to you about a story you've been covering with your colleague Kevin Rector, who is reporting today that Judge James Bradar has signed the proposed consent decree. So this is now a matter for the court. It's no longer a matter for just sort of idle speculation. What does that mean for the consent decree between Department of Justice, the City of Baltimore, and the Baltimore Police Department moving forward?
Well, I think it underscores why Mayor Catherine Pugh and the police department was so insistent on getting this signed and entered into the court before the Trump administration took office, because we now see some of the first actions of the new Department of Justice was to try to pull back from this consent decree and ask for delays and so forth. But the judge shut that down today. He said, nope, the Department of Justice already agreed to this, albeit under President Obama. We've had the negotiations, we've had the settlement talks, and now it's about moving forward with this police reform, not trying to get out of it.
And Domenico Montanaro, the Justice Department clearly has a very different posture about the notion of consent decrees moving forward. It's not going to be able to stop what's going on in Baltimore, evidently. But in other places around the country, a Sessions DOJ is a very different thing than a Loretta Lynch DOJ, is it not?
No question about that. Jeff Sessions was sort of an outlier senator in the Senate, and because he was somebody who got on board the Trump train pretty early, he winds up becoming attorney general. And there are a whole host of things, whether it's consent decrees with communities and how police organizations have tried to work with those communities in the aftermath of Ferguson and everything that happened in Baltimore and New York. There is no doubt that when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to marijuana, you know, just the idea that Jeff Sessions in October 2015 said that there are good people don't smoke marijuana, and you have states like Colorado and Washington State and even Maryland to an extent that are moving more toward liberalization of that. What does this Justice Department do with any of those things going forward over the next 4 years, when that's where they can really affect things.
Indeed. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's political editor. I appreciate the time, sir, and I look forward to the next time. Appreciate it. Thanks.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Luke Broadwater covers City Hall and local politics for the Baltimore Sun. We've got links to the work of Domenico Montanaro and Luke Broadwater on our website, WIPR.org/midday. Luke, appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Coming up Monday on Midday, we're going to have more on the consent decree between the Department of Justice and the Baltimore City Police. Kevin Rector is going to join us along with Bishop Douglas Miles and David Rocha of ACLU Maryland. That's coming up Monday on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coglin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.